So let's just do a quick review here. Of course, glucose is a monosaccharide, if you remember. Of course, and it is the preferred fuel source. So to drive all this stuff, glucose is what we tend to convert, even we're going to discover today, even when we start to use protein or lipids as a fuel source, we still have to convert it to glucose. So it still gets somewhat converted down to be able to use within this stuff. Now, as we know, insulin increases the rate of glucose in the cells. And what's interesting is in the liver and in the nervous system, especially the brain, it doesn't really require insulin. The sugars get in there naturally because they're so required. And as I said, once glucose enters into a cell, a phosphate molecule is added to it, so therefore it's phosphorylated. And here's the answer to the one question. So this whole form of oxidation of glucose, also known as cellular respiration, is the four: glycolysis, acetylcoenzyme A, and the Krebs cycle. So just remember that glycolysis is the most important means of energy release from the glucose molecule. So ultimately what we're doing is we need to find the energy in glucose, because what we're doing here fundamentally is creating ATP. Okay? Glucose means the splitting of a glucose molecule to form two pyruvates. There are 10 steps to do so. It does create 4 ATP, but it requires 2 ATP in order to do it, so therefore you get a net gain of 2. We have reactions that occur with the addition of phosphate group to glucose. It gets converted to fructose, and then another phosphate to the fructose itself. And this is where we have this ATP diverted to ATP in order for that to happen. That doubly phosphorylated molecule first, right? We get a phosphate added here in the first three reactions, and then we get, which converts it to, and then eventually to fructose, and then we get another phosphate group, so it is doubly phosphorylated. And it goes through further reactions to become pyruvic acid or pyruvate. You may see that in the text as well. Either is correct. Two energy-containing NAH, NADH are produced, and that's going to come back at some point here today. And then as we go through the last four steps, we create 4 ATP and 2 pyruvic acid. But please remember, in the earlier reactions, we had to use 2 ATP in order to get to this point, so therefore we only have a net gain of 2. The process does not require oxygen, so this is the anaerobic part. So if we're in an anaerobic state, this is how we produce ATP. Not the most efficient, does not create the most ATP, right? We want to get into aerobic metabolism in order to do so. Now, just for interest's sake, does anybody know how long it takes to move from anaerobic metabolism into aerobic metabolism, say, when you go for a run? 15 to 17 minutes. So if you're trying to, say, lose some adipose tissue on your body and you're going out for a run, you won't even start utilizing that material for at least 20 minutes. So you can have one Big Mac and get all the calories you need. It takes a lot of work to burn all those calories off at the end of the day. So you don't even go into aerobic metabolism until to almost 20 minutes, which for many people, they're done their aerobic workout in the gym, right? Quite often, right? 20 to 25 to 30 minutes, they're done. So in essence, you're not burning a whole lot of aerobic. You're not using aerobic metabolism in order to create ATP. So this is what we know as anaerobic cellular respiration. So we have created 2 pyruvate in this anaerobic process with a net gain of 2 ATP. So what happens to that pyruvate? It all depends on whether or not there's oxygen present, okay, for things to change. Remember that this is not happening inside the mitochondria yet, right? The oxygen is coming from somewhere else. So the fate of pyruvate acid depends on the availability of oxygen. If there is no oxygen, pyruvic acid is converted into lactic acid. And this is the reason why, I think I said last week, why your muscles burn when you're lifting weights, because you are anaerobically working. And so therefore, because oxygen is not present in the creation here of your ATP to do your weight training, you end up creating a byproduct of lactic acid. The problem with lactic acid is it's acidic, obviously. It doesn't change the environment within the muscle cells, and they can't function properly. But please remember, because again, you're going to hear this lots, you know, outside of the course, where lactic acid buildup results in delayed onset of muscle soreness, or massage improves lactic acid. It doesn't, okay? Because the body is already set up to deal with the lactic acid that gets produced in anaerobic metabolism. Therefore, if oxygen is scarce, pyruvic acid is reduced by the addition of two hydrogen atoms to form lactic acid. This process regenerates the NAD and allows glycolysis to continue. So it gets used, it comes back again, kind of recycles, reworks. If lactic acid is produced, it diffuses out of the cell very rapidly, enters the blood, goes to the liver, and is converted back to pyruvic acid. Okay? Now, if we move into aerobic metabolism, we're going to learn the pyruvic acid changes into something. And therefore, if the liver is changing lactic acid back into pyruvate, we have lots of pyruvate to create ATP aerobically as we move through. When oxygen is present, this pyruvate is converted to a product called coenzyme A. And it is the coenzyme A that enters the mitochondria to enter the Krebs cycle. So anaerobic metabolism is occurring outside the mitochondria, and so too is oxygen. The oxygen can convert the pyruvic acid into acetyl coenzyme A. And it is acetyl coenzyme A that goes into the mitochondria to now start creating ATP via the aerobic metabolism pathways. Okay? Everybody got that? Kind sorta. So remember, without oxygen, pyruvic acid is converted to lactic acid, and it gets converted back to lactic acid in the liver. It happens rapidly. In the presence of oxygen, pyruvate or pyruvic acid is converted into acetyl coenzyme A. So, a coenzyme is a substance that is enhances or is necessary for the action of enzymes to work. So it sets up for the enzymes to work better. Okay? So it's a precursor. Now what's interesting is this coenzyme comes from vitamin B. Okay? Pantothenic acid. So the reason I put this up here isn't to get picky about chemistry, but it's to make you realize how important your diet is and what your intake is for things like vitamins and minerals. Because when you get down into the nuts and bolts of cellular metabolism or chemical reactions, the body does in fact require vitamin C, vitamin B, vitamin D, vitamin K, vitamin A, and so forth. And any kind of lack of those, you start running into physiological issues with your body, right? This is why we see in our North American culture, because we all eat such processed foods, they're lacking a lot of the, shall we say, down-to-earth compounds that happen under normal cooking conditions, growing in soil, those sorts of things. And the moment that we process them, we tend to remove all those. You know, it's kind of interesting. Wheat contains lots of great chemicals and vitamins and minerals. But because we process it so much that when we make cereal, we have to add vitamins into the cereal so that it's actually healthy for you. Or meanwhile, the grain actually did have that before it started going through all the mechanisms of processing to become, well, I don't eat Wonder Bread. I don't know if anybody else here eats Wonder Bread, but it's not really bread. You can take a slice of Wonder Bread and squeeze it to a ball about that big. So, well, oh, did you? Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yes. 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 So.
Country harvest loaf, on the other hand, it almost fills the pan before it goes to the roof.
Make your own.
Yeah.
Just make your own. It's easy to make bread. Come on. If COVID taught us anything, it's how to make bread, right? So. This coenzyme is done in the presence of oxygen in relationship to that. You know, we had pyruvic acid or pyruvate. We end up with this conversion in the presence of O2. And what, in fact, the O2 is doing is it's preparing the pyruvate to enter into the Krebs cycle. So this is a Krebs cycle. You'll need to know all this by the midterm. I'm kidding. You don't. I don't get into, yeah. I my expectation is not this, to know all this, but you do need to understand it, okay? So you can see up here at the top, right, our hydrogen that's added here within the 10, you know, the 10 to 15 processes that occur chemically to convert pyruvic acid into coenzyme A, all right? You need coenzyme A to enter into the Krebs cycle. So pyruvic acid can't enter into this cycle. It has to be converted to acetyl coenzyme A, then that can enter the cycle. Now, what I want you to take, maybe I'm going to go back and repeat this, so don't write for a minute. Just listen and follow. You can see that there are many, many chemical reactions that occur in the citric acid cycle or the Krebs cycle. What do you see here as byproducts of all of these? So in the circle, obviously the arrows represent the chemical reactions from beginning to end, and all the red in the middle are the conversions to the various compounds within the Krebs cycle as it works its way through. What I want you to take note of, what are the byproducts of those chemical reactions as it goes around the circle? What do you see lots of there? Hydrogen, carbon dioxide, because of the reaction of hydrogen with water in the chemical reaction, right? So when we're creating ATP, this is where our carbon dioxide comes from, that we have to breathe off when we're breathing. So right now in all your cells, you're creating ATP. Just simply writing your pens on your pads requires muscle contraction in order for that to happen. So you need ATP. Your diaphragm's contracting to help you breathe, needs ATP, and on and on and on. So you are, in fact, actually going through these and an unbelievable amount of cells at your body at any given time with the byproduct of water, hydrogen, and carbon dioxide. So you can see quite a bit, right? And ultimately what's happening is, just to let you know, all these reactions, and the reason why it sometimes it's called the citric acid cycle is because acetyl coenzyme A comes in and starts as oxaloacetic acid. The cool thing about the cycle is it starts with oxaloacetic acid and ends with oxaloacetic acid. So it always comes back to the same. Just keeps going around. And what's important to understand here are the side effects, what happens within these. So this is with all the stuff removed. And no, you don't need to know all these. Please understand you don't need all these. But just understand that you're taking a compound at the beginning, acetyl coenzyme A, and you are converting it chemically. And in doing so, you're creating a few things that are required later on. What have you not seen in that cycle? Well, the water it's good call, because it's a result of hydrogen that goes in with these chemical reactions. And remember, this is done in the presence of oxygen. It just naturally becomes a byproduct because of their affinity for each other. But what don't you see there? What have you always been told about the Krebs cycle? What does it create? Right. ATP. Do you see any there? Yeah. That's it. Okay. Our next step after this is going to be called the electron transport chain. The electron transport chain utilizes the compounds that are created in the Krebs cycle to create ATP. So because they're so interconnected, when we talk about the Krebs cycle and aerobic metabolism, when we come up with the 32 ATPs that get created, it's because of the association, the very intimate association between the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain. But what's shocking is you don't really see a lot of ATP there, right? But you've always been taught that it produces 32, correct? If you've taken it, all right? So just understand that there's all these, and all you're doing is you're adding and subtracting carbon into these, and you're getting byproducts. We'll get back to that. So we've done this. We've converted the pyruvic acid into acetyl coenzyme A, and now it's ready to go into the Krebs cycle. Krebs cycle is also known as the citric acid cycle or the tricarboxylic acid cycle. I will never give you that one, but the Krebs cycle is pretty much the term that I always use, and I think you've probably all been taught kind of the Krebs cycle is what you were used. Maybe Krebs is an individual who created this. I don't know. Was it? Okay. Yes. So within the Krebs cycle, there are 9 biochemical reactions in which the acetyl portion of the acetyl coenzyme A is degraded to carbon dioxide and hydrogen atoms. So we don't even use the CoA, we use the acetyl. Remember, CoA is a precursor to enzymatic influence of chemical reactions. Okay? So it uses the acetyl. So it gets degraded to carbon dioxide and hydrogen. All of this is occurring in the matrix. Okay, so remember the matrix is? You had the hard candy shell on the mitochondria. You had the convoluted inner membrane. And the fluid within the cristae of the inner membrane is the matrix. Okay, so this is all occurring in there. This Krebs cycle and all these chemical reactions. Okay. The released hydrogen is oxidized, which releases large amounts of energy to produce ATP. But not the Krebs cycle, somewhere else, which we'll get to. Remember this. The released hydrogen is oxidized, which releases large amounts of energy to produce ATP. The cycle begins with oxaloacetic acid and ends with the formation of oxaloacetic acid. So therefore, this cycle can run indefinitely. And folks, every single cell in your body has mitochondria. So every single cell in your body is producing vast amounts of ATP at any given time. Your ability just to go for a run, the vast amounts of ATP you need to create just to go for a run it's astronomical. The cycle cannot begin, though, until an acetyl group is attached to CoA. So that, and when did that happen? That happened in the first step, which was the creation of pyruvic acid in the presence of, right, glycolysis in the presence of oxygen, right? So we needed two things. We needed pyruvate or pyruvic acid, and we needed oxygen. And then once we had those two, we create acetyl coenzyme A, and then the whole process starts that we're about to talk about. Everybody follow me? Okay? So we can see it here. So the remaining CoA is released and can be used for formation of still more quantities of acetyl CoA to form pyruvic acid. Now remember, how many pyruvic acid do we have? So therefore we had two acetyl CoA. So that means that for every molecule of glucose, we get two cycles of the Krebs cycle. Okay? So that's why that acetyl-CoA, the acetyl goes in, the CoA goes back and will eventually attach to another pyruvic acid in the presence of oxygen to become, as you can see, how it just continues on. But every single glucose molecule gives us two cycles, okay? The acetyl portion becomes an integral part of the citric acid molecule. And then during the stages of the process, we have several molecules of water that are added and CO2 and hydrogen are released, as well as extra water. In the next eight successive steps, the atoms of the citric acid are rearranged and they produce intermediate molecules. Most are called keto acids. Now, diabetics have a hard time with this, and they can accumulate keto acids. It's called ketoacidosis. What's interesting is there's this new diet out there that has everybody put themselves into ketoacidosis. Most times when a diabetic is in ketoacidosis, it's an emergency and you have to go to Emerge. And yet we have people putting themselves in ketosis all the time, thinking they're going to lose weight. Okay? We don't want to do this. It's unhealthy. It's unhealthy. It's not good for you. You know, they're finding people who are long-term on these. Like, because my understanding, too, is on this keto diet, you're only supposed to do it for, what, maximum of 14 days or something like that. You're supposed to cycle in and cycle out. And yet there are people that are on this keto diet for months on end, and then they go to the doctor and their liver's shutting down, right? It's just not a good thing. It's not great for the body, okay? As I said, if diabetics get into ketoacidosis, it's an emergency, and they have to deal with it. So why people are doing to themselves, I don't know. It's like eating cabbage soup, right? You know, in the 70s, like, eat cabbage soup, you'll lose 30 pounds. Yeah, great. Yeah, it's because you probably have diarrhea so bad you're so dehydrated because of all the freaking cabbage, right? So, that acetic acid is broken down carbon by carbon, and because it's broken down carbon by carbon, we'd say it's decarboxylated. So that's what that means, we're removing carbons. And is oxidized, and this simultaneously generates NADH, don't worry about the plus H for now, NADH, but that hydrogen is important, and FADH. And these are proteins that act as enzymes for further chemical reactions, okay? At the end of the cycle, acetic acid has been completely disposed of, and oxaloacetic is regenerated, and the oxaloacetic acid is the pickup molecule, and it picks up the acetyl group. So we want oxaloacetic acid at the end of the cycle because it's oxaloacetic that picks up the acetyl group from the acetyl coenzyme A that was created from the pyruvic acid in the presence of oxygen. Follow me so far?
Nope.
Right, so remember, you've got anaerobic, you always have to have anaerobic metabolism first before you have aerobic metabolism because you have to create the pyruvic acid first. So you always have anaerobic metabolism before you have aerobic metabolism. Then in the presence of oxygen, boys will be boys, in the presence of oxygen, then you get pyruvate that ends up getting turned into acetyl coenzyme A and we start the cycle, right? Okay. If I ran up there and started screaming at them, you think they'd run down the hallway? Yeah, my luck, somebody would pull a knife and you guys would be calling 911 because I'd be lying in a puddle of blood in the hallway or something, right? Okay. Yeah. So, because two decarboxylation and four oxidation events occur, the products of the Krebs cycle are two molecules of CO2, and four molecules of reduced coenzymes, three NADH and one FADH. I promise that will make sense in a moment. Right now you're like, yeah, I know exactly. Okay? Just understand that we have oxidation and decarboxylation occurring. So we're removing carbons, we're oxidizing things, and we come up with these byproducts. Now, these... I will tell you this. These two things right here, they bugger off. They're going to the electron transport chain, okay? That's where they get used. So they are required to be made to be used in the electron transport chain, NADH and the FADH. There is addition of water at certain steps, which accounts for the release of hydrogen atoms, and that, they bugger off, and they go to the electron transport chain too. Yes? Every book you look at just gives you NADH at this level. Because at the end of the day, what's important only is it's an enzyme, it's a protein enzyme which allows chemical reactions, and we want the hydrogens. Out of the Krebs cycle, what's really important is hydrogen atoms, and we'll learn why shortly. Now, let's account. Oh, by the way, so when we go through, we have two molecules of ATP, remember? One glucose molecule became two pyruvates, which became two acetyl-CoAs. Therefore, the Krebs cycle did create ATP, but only two from one glucose. Okay? Let's now account for the pyruvic acid molecules that enter the mitochondria. A total of three carbon dioxides and five molecules of these, equal to the removal of 10 hydrogen atoms, are formed for each pyruvic acid molecule. So there are two. So please understand that we want these two enzymes, these proteins, for down the road, and we also want these hydrogens, which we'll talk about shortly as to where they go and why they're important. Therefore, the products of oxidation in the Krebs cycle are twice that, because one glucose gives us two pyruvic acid, and pyruvic acid, of course, gets converted to acetyl coenzyme A, so therefore we get six CO2, 10 molecules of reduced coenzymes, and two ATP molecules. So one cycle, or one glucose molecule, gives us all of that. So when you're breathing off CO2, it is the chemical reactions that occur in the Krebs cycle that give us the CO2 that we need to blow off. Okay? But for now, just understand that we've got these right here. Okay? Did you give them some business? Okay. Yes. Yes, so what happens is the CO2 that gets created as a byproduct has to leave the mitochondria and then leaves the cell that the mitochondria is sitting in. Once it leaves the cell that the mitochondria is sitting in, it goes into interstitial fluids. Capillary beds that lie within the tissue, within the interstitial fluids between the cells, picks up the carbon dioxide, which travels through the bloodstream, which gets to the lungs, and we blow it off. The reduced coenzymes carry their own electrons in high energy linkages and they must be now oxidized if we want things to continue, which we'll get to. Although the Krebs cycle is exclusive to carbohydrate oxidation, we can break down products of carbohydrates, fats, and proteins that can feed into this process. But we do have to change proteins and lipids into something else in order to feed into the furnace. I always think of the Krebs cycle as a furnace, right? So you're fueling it. So acetyl fuels it, right? Glucose initially fuels it because we needed glucose in the first place to be created into pyruvic acid to go into the cycle itself, all right? Okay, so maybe this will help. Okay, so let's go back just for a moment. Let's go back for a moment, which in this case we're going forward. Okay, so the acetyl-CoA, the coenzyme exists. So within the context when we have the pyruvic acid and oxygen, we create the acetyl group within it. So we're saying that we convert pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA. So the coenzyme's already created, and the pyruvate works with the coenzyme to create the acetyl coenzyme. And when we get into the Krebs cycle, the acetyl group leaves, goes into the Krebs cycle, and the coenzyme comes back and attaches and creates the acetyl-CoA with the pyruvic acid. Again, the next one coming through. Okay? All right. So, the electron transport chain, I'm going to come back to these. No, I'm not, actually. I know we just did a video, but I think it's important to sit and watch this before I talk about it, okay? Because then I think you'll have a better understanding of what I'm talking about. So we'll watch this first, and then, I didn't have to start recording, and then we'll talk about it. So I think it's important to... You know, my brother was telling me he went to Timmy's down the South End, and their coffee is 25 cents or 30 cents more than everywhere else in town because they decided they're going to charge more. I didn't think so, but I guess I did. No, it's down the South End. It's a standalone Tim's, and they charge more. I know, it's kind of weird. Yeah. Okay. Oh, my dad's wife's son owns one. It's not fun. You got to pay a lot of money. So. When we talk about, when we talk about aerobic metabolism, it's a bit of a, it doesn't exactly express what's happening. So the first statement says, like glycolysis, none of the reactions in the Krebs cycle directly use oxygen, okay? Even though oxygen does get utilized, but we did have oxygen present, which converted the pyruvic acid to acetyl-coenzyme A, right? So it was kind of involved there, but it's the electron transport chain, and you saw the molecular oxygen in the video, in the second transporter, right? So H2O means every molecule of water has two hydrogen and single oxygen. You remember you saw the electrons go in, two water molecules came, right, and gave off their two hydrogen and a byproduct of water. So it's the exclusive function of the electron transport chain utilizes oxygen. And this oversees the final catabolic reactions that occur in the mitochondria. So because the reduced coenzymes that are produced, remember the reduced coenzymes are NADH and FADH2, remember that. Because the reduced coenzymes produced during the Krebs cycle are the grist of the electron transport chain mill, the pathways are coupled and both phases are considered to be oxygen requiring. What's grist and mill? What's getting at there? Grist and mill. Think of pioneer days when they made flour. What did they do? You got it. With the grist mill did what? Yeah. So that from a sort of demonstrative perspective, right, we're saying that the coenzymes are the grist, and it is the electron transport chain that grinds or catabolizes or breaks down the coenzymes, which results in what we get from it. I didn't do it. I just copied. I got that out of the book and thought, that's kind of cool because it's breaking down. It's grinding it down and making the byproducts. So the hydrogens that are removed during oxidation of food fuels are now combining with oxygen, and the energy released is harnessed that creates that second to third phosphate molecule. I will repeat. The hydrogens removed during the oxidation of food fuels. The oxidation of food fuels was the Krebs cycle, because you were getting hydrogen molecules created off the Krebs cycle, correct? Along with the enzymes FADH2 and NADH, yeah.
Can you please
explain
that together?
Yeah, no, just understand. All you need to understand is that you have these products created in the Krebs cycle, and it's the responsibility of the electron transport chain to break down those enzymes that were created, those coenzymes, so that FADH2 and the NADH. It's just a metaphor for the Krebs cycle creates the products, and the electron transport chain breaks them down to create what we're after. I would never ask you a question on that. Don't worry about that. No. Okay? So, as I said, the hydrogens removed during the oxidation of food fuels are now combined with oxygen, and the energy released is harnessed to attach to phosphate groups to ADP. Again, right, that's what creates ATP, creating an inorganic phosphate, the third to the second. This is known then as oxidative phosphorylation. When we phosphorylate, we are adding a phosphate, right? So the fact that we're adding a third phosphate to an ADP molecule, we are actually phosphorylating the ADP, aren't we?
Yes.
To create ATP. Okay. So we can see it here, kind of like the video, only in a single slide without movement. You know, here's our NADH coming in, and we're pumping hydrogen. So we can see that when the NADH goes into complex one with the electrons that are part of NADH, so you can see here NADH comes in and has an interaction with complex one and then turns it into what? What's missing? Right, because it's the hydrogen that goes in the complex, or the electron, which attracts the hydrogen molecule to pump up to the other side. Because the whole purpose of all of this is to get more hydrogen on that side than on that side. Yes? Because we want a concentration gradient, which gives us a charge, which is what we require in order to have the second and third phosphate molecules together. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, because there's so much more on this side of the membrane to this side. So it's potentially more positive on the outside than it is on the inside. It's a great statement because we're not seeing an overabundance of negative ions on the other side. It's just that there's more positive on the one side of the membrane, so we have a potential difference between the two. Therefore, we get the charge just because of the potential difference. Okay. And remember, we're talking about the proton itself having its own energy mass, right? So we utilize that within it because it is H+. So it does have its own inherent energy. Okay. So as we see here, ultimately what we're after is that these two products that are created in the Krebs cycle give off their hydrogen and their electron, which allows hydrogen to go to the other side. We then start taking that electron and transporting it to complex two, where two electrons, right, will then have FADH do the same thing, losing hydrogen. Then the two electrons via cytochrome C go into complex 4. Now, complex 4 is a bit different because it utilizes oxygen. So we have the two electrons, two hydrogen, and half an oxygen. Of course, there's twice, but we're not going to worry about that for now. Just understanding that, again, we're moving hydrogen. Folks, I am not going to get into the nitty-gritty in questions, so please understand I'm not trying to make it complicated, and I'm not going to be asking you any wild questions on this material. What I'm trying to get through to you is that those things that were created in the Krebs cycle, are utilized to create the gradient difference. That's really what I'm after. Just understanding that there is a gradient difference so that we have the charge. Okay? So, the electron transport chain involves a sequence of electron carrier molecules. They are found on the inner mitochondrial membrane, and they're capable of oxidation and reduction. Remember, reduction actually gives you, right, okay? So, as the electrons pass through the chain, there's a release of energy that's used to form ATP, and the last electron acceptor is oxygen, okay? So, in that complex four is the last one, and we use oxygen as a carrier, all right, to get hydrogen to the other side. Okay. This mechanism of ATP creation links chemical reactions with the pumping process, so therefore we can call it chemiosmosis. Okay, I just get me to understand that we're using chemical reactions to create the difference. So, here we go. Energy from NADHH passes along the chain, and it's used to pump hydrogen, which is protons, from the matrix of the mitochondria into the space between the inner and outer membranes. Okay? The whole purpose is to get a whole bunch of hydrogen in that space between the inner and outer membrane. So out of the matrix, into that other area. Okay? Two, a high concentration of hydrogen accumulates between the inner and outer mitochondrial membranes. So we're starting to create the concentration difference by having an excessive amount of hydrogen on the outside of the inner membrane. Three, ATP synthesis occurs as hydrogen diffuses back into the mitochondrial matrix through a special type of hydrogen channel in the inner membrane, which we know as ATP synthase. Remember, this is why we teach you the osmosis and all the diffusion, all that kind of stuff, because of the fact that there's a greater amount of hydrogen on the outside of the membrane than the inside of the membrane. What does that outer hydrogen want to do? It wants to get to the inside to find equilibrium, right? Equilibrium. Okay, so it wants to get back. The only way it can get back is through that last ATP synthase, which is architecturally created to accept the hydrogen molecule one at a time as it spins and turns around. Because the hydrogen doesn't have to do anything to get the hydrogen to move across the membrane because it desperately wants to move across the membrane under the rules of diffusion. Okay? So it's just this modification of this machine that picks up the hydrogen molecules one at a time. It's using the energy of the protons to actually come through and twist.
Yeah.
Okay? So that's where the energy comes from. There are five electron carriers, and that's the key thing. When we go here, we can see that it's electrons that come off of these compounds. Electron, electron, two electrons, electrons. It's all about the electrons. So we can say that these electron carriers is flavin mononucleotide, cytochromes, iron sulfur centers, copper, and ubiquinones. I won't even ask you questions on those individually. I just want you to understand that electrons that come out of the compounds that were created in the electron transport chain utilizes compounds that were created in the Krebs cycle to move electrons, therefore pumping hydrogen from the matrix to the space between the inner and outer membranes, creating a concentration difference gradient. Correct. Okay? That's what you really need to grasp. Okay? So, the first step in the chain is the transfer of electrons from the NADH to flavin mononucleotides. Remember, glycolysis created two NADHH plus 2H, okay? So that came from glycolysis. Glycolysis, if you remember from the con video, glycolysis was the first step, and it was anaerobic, correct? Okay? It was the first step before we even got to the Krebs cycle yet. First step, glycolysis created two NADH And we had to understand that, you know, they're going to head off to the electron transport chain. We also created two more from the formation of acetyl-CoA and six from the Krebs cycle. So we have lots of these enzymes that are going to use their electrons to help pump through hydrogen via the electron carriers. No, pyruvate was... No, yeah, glycolysis created the pyruvate. Pyruvate in the presence of oxygen became acetyl coenzyme A. The acetyl went into the Krebs cycle, and through the various chemical reactions in the Krebs cycle, we created NADH and FADH2, correct? And those are the compounds that are utilized in the electron transport chain. Well, his name tells you that, right? It's a chain of movements of electrons, the electron transport chain. So it's transporting electrons, and as it does so, this utilizes the pumping action of these electron carriers to pump hydrogen to the other side, thus creating the difference. Right. Any awe moments yet? That's what. Yes. Yeah, across, yeah. Any aha moments? Anybody just figure that out? Okay, all right. So, in the second step, the new compound passes electrons to the next center, and then to the next, which picks up an additional hydrogen. The electrons are then passed successively from one to the next carrier, and each carrier is reduced as it picks up electrons and oxidizes as it loses electrons. The last carrier, of course, passes its electrons to half of a molecule of oxygen, which then becomes negatively charged, picking up two hydrogens to form H2O. So in the last one that utilizes oxygen, we do pump hydrogen from one side to the other, but as a byproduct, we get two molecules of water. Again, don't get caught up on the chemical reactions. Just understanding that we're all about hydrogen here, okay? Right. Within the inner mitochondrial membrane, the carriers of the electron transport chain cluster into three complexes, and therefore they form proton pumps. So they are pumping the proton hydrogen from the inner to the outer membrane, from inside the inner membrane to outside the inner membrane. I should say that properly. Each acts as a proton pump that expels hydrogen and therefore creates the electrochemical gradient of hydrogen. Of course, this includes further electron carriers, and one electron carrier ferries electrons from the first to the second complex, and the second carrier carries the electrons from the second to the third. So if we go back to here, complex one takes the NADH, right? And then we get the movement of hydrogen. Then we have a carrier that carries the electron from complex one to complex two. In the meantime, the carrier is interacted with FADH2, so it too has moved hydrogen across. Then the electron that was transported initially from the NADH goes into complex 2 and then cytochrome C, and all the while, all it's doing is just pumping hydrogen to the other side as it moves through. A buildup of hydrogen on one side of the membrane confers a positive charge there, whereas the other side has a negative. So therefore, we have a gradient that has a potential charge. Now, where the specific channel exists, hydrogen can diffuse back across the membrane, again, driven by its proton force, the fact that it's positive, and it wants to get to the other side for equilibrium. As the hydrogen diffuses back across, they generate ATP because the channels contain an enzyme called ATP synthase. So this compound that was doing the little twisty-turny thing, picking up an individual hydrogen molecule, right, it contains an enzyme. Anytime you see A's, it means an enzyme, right? And that what that does, it uses that proton motive force to create the energy, thus taking the ADP, adding the third phosphate, resulting in ATP. It takes the proton energy to create the high energy bond between the second and the third phosphate molecule. This process is responsible for most of the ATP produced during cellular respiration. Now, the two NADH produced in the cytosol during glycolysis cannot themselves enter the mitochondria, but they do donate their electrons to transfer molecules. So in glycolysis, we created NADH, but again, because that happened outside the mitochondria, everybody remember that, right? It's anaerobic, so it's created outside the mitochondria, but those electrons can be utilized, even though the NADH itself can't get in. So basically, it functions as a stepwise release of electronic energy to pump protons from the fluid matrix into the intermembranous space. And the difference of hydrogen between the two membranes creates a voltage across the membrane, and this condition strongly attracts the protons back into the matrix, and therefore the proton energy of the hydrogen itself gives us a high energy bond in that complex that contains the ATP synthase. Brian is just massaged. So, these various electron transfers generate 32 or 34 ATP from each molecule of glucose. Ultimately, one molecule of glucose gives you a bucket load of ATP in aerobic respiration, okay? Which is, of course, your Krebs cycle in your electron transport chain. From the 10 molecules of NADHH, 28 or 30 ATP are produced, and two more from FADH2. Therefore, during aerobic respiration, 36 or 38 ATP can be generated from one molecule of glucose. Anaerobic metabolism created four with a net gain of two, whereas aerobic metabolism, meaning the interaction between the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain, gives us significantly more ATP. Okay? Here's one thing that's interesting, which we'll learn a little bit later on in this course. Heart muscle inside your heart can only utilize aerobic metabolism. It really doesn't rely on anaerobic metabolism. This is why when you get a blood clot in a coronary artery and the part of the muscle of the heart doesn't get blood, it dies because it can't create ATP to generate, or it can't generate ATP unless it has blood supply, which brings oxygen to that tissue. So it dies. That's what happens in a heart attack. You just stop blood flow to the heart muscle and it doesn't like it and it dies. Now, I said, you know, that the preferred fuel is glucose. So, what's wrong? Where are we here? We can obviously create fuel sources from other fuel, because we do have, you know, we've been talking about monosaccharides, meaning carbohydrates. But, of course, other fuel sources are fats and proteins, right? So when we have a situation where we have too little glucose, glycerol and amino acids are converted to glucose. So glycerol, of course, is a form of fats, and amino acids, of course, are part of proteins. So the process of forming new sugar from non-carbohydrate molecules is called gluconeogenesis, and this occurs in the liver. So when we start running out of a glucose fuel source, the body will turn to other sources in order to feed the furnace. This is why I say, a good 20 minutes of a run, you haven't got into any of your fat stores yet. Now you've got to get out there and be asking for fuel sources much longer before the body turns to proteins or lipids to start creating more glucose to feed the fire. I think so, because it still does, but there is some research that shows, because I'm a morning fasting working out guy. I always have. I never eat before I work out first thing in the morning. I'm always have fasted the night before. I have a cup of tea and then I do my workout. I do use a pre-enduring electrolyte drink just to make sure my energy's out to be able to perform properly, but I never eat until after I work out. Yep. So, now I know that I should bring them into you because this is new. They've done something with glucose that's easier to absorb and maintains a higher. So I'm trying it. It seems to be working, but I'm not sure why. So, this protects the body, the nervous system in particular, from damaging effects of low blood sugar by ensuring that ATP creation can continue. So, you know, again, glucose is the preferred source. But here's the thing. When we look at calories per gram, what has the highest calorie count per gram? Carbs, fats, or proteins? Fats. Carbs and proteins, or sugars and proteins, are 4, and fat is 9. So we get a lot of energy from it. So, well, it's a good fuel source, but again, it takes time to get there. So, yeah, you're forcing the body to start utilizing the fats quicker to build ATP. I don't know. I've never done it. I don't know that much about it. Are you? Interesting. Okay.
Basically, you're like low carb or no carb.
Yeah. Now, do you urinate a lot when you're on a keto diet? Like excessively?
I only really did it for 3 days.
Did you find you were urinating more?
I needed
bread. Did you find that you urinated more? Because I know when a diabetic's in ketoacidosis, they tend to have a higher amount of urine. They create a lot more urine. They have to pee a lot when they're in that state. So I just wondered, are you told on that diet to make sure that your water intake is quite high? Like, do you have to drink a lot of water with it? Okay. Interesting. 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 You know, I think the biggest problem with our society with this obesity issue is nothing more than we just, if you think of a teeter-totter, our activity levels are here and our eating is here, and that's the problem. We need to get at least to here, if not for a while, to there. No, they don't. No, it's natural food. That's the good thing about it. That's why when you eat a proper meal, you feel full for longer. If you have a McDonald's hamburger, within an hour or a bit later, you're like, oh God, I'm starving. I need something to eat, because it just goes through your body. And oh yeah, some of that stuff that may stay with you and be detrimental to your health, but as far as making you full and fulfilling your needs from this kind of perspective. Yeah, that's why, you know, you eat a chocolate bar, your sugars go like this, go like that, right? So, whereas if you have an apple, you kind of maintain you feel better with it, that kind of stuff. So, we just said this, fats are the body's most concentrated form of energy, and they contain very little water, and of course, as we just said, twice the yield of energy as compared to carbohydrates and proteins. So, fats contain twice as many calories per gram than the other two. Most of the products of fat digestion are transported in the lymph in the form of fatty protein droplets called chylomicrons. So, and that travels through the lymph. So many people think, you know, fats travel through the blood system. They don't. They actually travel in the lymph system to the liver. So when you eat and it goes to your intestinal tract, your villi, within a villi, you have an artery, you have a vein, and you have a lymph. You have a nerve in there too, but you have a lymph, a vessel. And the fats, it's milky. It actually looks milky, and it actually gets picked up by the lymph, and that's what transports to the liver for processing, okay? And no, that's cholesterol. So there are cholesterols too high. So it, and as we said, cholesterol is a firm fat, which provides structure to a cell membrane. That's why they look hard, and it just means they have high cholesterol, which isn't really good, and it's depositing in tissues. Because there's nowhere else to go. There's too much everywhere else. So, eventually the lipids in the chylomicrons, they're hydrolyzed by plasma enzymes, proteins again, right? And the resulting fatty acids and glycerol are taken up by the body cells where then it becomes processed. And they can be oxidized to help form ATP. But if the fats aren't needed, then they're stored in adipose tissue. So this is what adipose tissue is. It's the body measures its needs. And as I said with that exercise teeter-totter, if you're not asking for much and you're packing in calories through your diet, your body recognizes that you don't need those calories right now because you're not actively requiring them. And again, from an evolutionary perspective, where we, you know, had periods of time where there'd be drought or we couldn't eat well, we became really good at storing adipose tissue for the rainy day when there wasn't enough food around, and we would live off of those energy stores. Now, because of the availability of food materials and whatnot, we don't get, you know, in first world nations, I should say, not third world nations, you're less likely to run into a situation where you're not starving, shall we say, right? So if the fats are not needed, they're formed in adipose tissue. Now, you can get some of these lipids, as we know, in the cell membrane, in the spilipid layer. Some of those fats can be utilized in maintaining cell membranes, all those sorts of things. So the main function then of adipose tissue is to remove triglycerides from chylomicrons and very low-density lipoproteins until they're stored and needed for ATP production. So the whole purpose of stored fat on your body is just so that it's there for the need to make ATP at a time when the body's running low on fuel sources to create ATP, and then it will turn to the fatty products, the lipids in your body, to then convert and make into a product that can be used by this whole system we talked about to create ATP. Now, the various lipids, only neutral triglycerides, are routinely oxidized for energy. So we have these neutral fats get catabolized. Therefore, we separate oxidation of their two different building blocks, glycerol and fatty acid chains. Okay. Now, most of the cells of the body convert glycerol to glyceraldehyde phosphate. And now the glyceraldehyde phosphate is an intermediate that flows into the Krebs cycle as one of the chemical reactions. So we have to take lipids and convert them into glyceraldehyde phosphate in order to have an appropriate fuel source to step into the Krebs cycle to help create ATP. Yes, well, eventually it would be. Okay. Now, glyceraldehyde, though, is interesting enough, it's not as great a fuel source as glycerol because it's only half of a glycerol molecule. So glyceraldehyde only makes one pyruvate, not two. Okay? It's not as efficient. Yeah, well, in terms of its production of ATP or pyruvate in glycolysis. Beta oxidation. So we have this fatty acid, and we oxidize it in the mitochondria. There are many types of reactions within this because, you know, a lot of work has to be done because it's not a simple glucose. We have to break it down a lot more. But the net result is the fatty acids are broken apart into two carbon acidic acid fragments and reduced coenzymes, which is, of course, what we want. We then have an acidic acid molecule that's formed through this. It fuses to a coenzyme, therefore then creating acetyl-coenzyme A. I will repeat. The fatty acid has to be oxidated in the mitochondria. And those oxidative processes result in a fatty acid that is broken apart into two carbon acidic acid fragments, and then we get reduced coenzymes out of that. And the acidic acid molecule that's formed through this can then fuse to acetyl-coenzyme A, which then, of course, then can enter into the Krebs cycle through all those chemical processes. The enzymes remove one pair of carbon atoms at a time from the long chain of carbon atoms that make up a fatty acid. If you ever saw a fatty acid, they're kind of cool. You see these all these carbons like in this long line with a little twisty turn at the end, and they're all bound together. That's what kind of makes it. So think of the tails, right? A fatty acid is the tails in the bilipid layer. If we had a phosphate head and two fatty acids, those tails of the fatty acids, think of carbon attached to a carbon, 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 carbon. Those are all what a fatty acid is made of. So what we're saying is a 16-carbon fatty acid, such as palmitic acid, can yield a net of 129 molecule, ATP molecules, via this beta oxidation, the Krebs cycle, and the electron transport chain. Because these fatty acids have so many carbons in them, which is what a fatty acid is, You therefore, because of the oxidation chemical reactions that occur in the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain, they can create 129 as compared to just the 36 with a glucose molecule. Yeah. You want to, it's not the preferred source. So even though the fatty acids can utilize a significant amount of ATP, the body won't turn to those initially. Like I said, you got to cardio for 20 minutes before it even starts thinking about turning to lipids. Glucose first. It'll use up all your glucose first. Well, not all of it, but a significant amount of it. Then the body recognizes that the stored glucose is starting to run out. Then it'll start to turn to lipids to build ATP. This is why, folks, you know, marathon runners, are they fat? No, because they work out for such extended periods of time. They do turn to breaking down lipids for their fuel sources. Therefore, they start to disappear. Now, if you diet too long, or you go into some of these things that are happening, and you start to starve, I could use the term starvation before, there's a problem that happens there. When we start utilizing most of our lipids, what do we turn to? Yep. You'll start catabolizing. So this is what happens. Unfortunately, if anybody here has had the experience of a friend or someone in the family who was quite large, a large individual, they got cancer and then they're down to like 90 pounds or whatever, because what happens is the cancer is like, it's like a parasite, and it starts eating the body, and the body starts recognizing that, so it starts catabolizing itself to maintain, stay alive. The cancer. Well, the chemo can. Right, but if you didn't have the chemo, they would still catabolize themselves, because the body says, because the cancer is basically, if you have eating food and utilizing body systems, cancer's in the middle, and like a parasite is that, shall we say, calories are on their way to help the body. The cancer just starts sucking it all up, and there's not much getting to the body, so the body turns to the body. So first it'll eat all the fats or break down all the fats, then it will start to break down all the proteins, and you start losing all that mass. It's the whole reason why they invented anabolic steroids. They tried to supersede what cancer was doing to the catabolism that was occurring, and they thought that by injecting cancer individuals that were in stage, that they would start hopefully stimulating building up of muscle mass that would extend their life to some degree. It has its own metabolic needs. Think of a cancer as a parasite. You know, a parasite on a tree? It kills its host, right? It needs to feed itself, but it doesn't realize that it's so greedy, it actually kills the host it's attached to, and eventually it dies. The same thing happens with cancer. It's like a parasite. It feeds off of your normal physiological processes to maintain itself to the point where the host that it's in eventually can't even take care of itself any longer. Yes, very. Yeah, I think it's crazy. And if your normal physiology has metabolic processes at this level, cancer's up here. It's just working constantly to take care of itself. And then, yeah, what do? We give people chemotherapy, poison the hell out of them. Right? Cause, have you ever seen a nurse give chemotherapy? Oh, they're suited up. They're in, yeah, because the stuff is poison. Yes. Right. Yes, it's yeah. It's crazy. No. Well, that's where they tried cannabis too, right? To hopefully stimulate appetite. Right, to help them. So some thoughts at that. Now I haven't heard a lot of really positive things about that. Some people say that it works well for them that I've spoken to, that they might smoke a joint or something, try to get the munchies and feed. It also helps with the nausea too. It's supposed to lower the nausea as well. So, well, they do give you medications to do it. Now, I can say, through just some people recently in my life, some of the chemo is not quite as bad as it used to be in some cases. It used to be that it would just rack your body, just terrible stuff. But some of the new stuff they got isn't, I guess it still makes you not feel very unwell. But I had a friend who had colon cancer, and to the point where he was only 40, he lost like a good chunk of his sigmoid colon, part of his rectum. And, of course, he had a colostomy because they were letting it heal. And he was on chemo and everything, but, man, the guy still came out and he curls once a week, even though he wouldn't last very long. But he was ill, but he wasn't what we picture sometimes of people on chemo where they're just bedridden and can't move. Now, that's only because of the chemo he happened to be on for that type of cancer. There are still individuals who are extremely – radiation, I find, is even worse than chemo. Oh. Yeah. Well, I can tell you guys, just as a side, so everybody talked about the COVID vaccine, correct? And everybody thought that that technology was new. Well, it's not, actually. The technology that created the COVID-19 vaccine is actually technology that's been used since 92 to help take chemotherapy and make it more precise. So think of like precision bombing and just carpet bombing. So in the past, we carpet bombed. We just gave them chemotherapy that would not only kill the cancer cells, but also normal cells. Now, with the technology that was used to create the COVID vaccine, they could actually take chemotherapy and better target it, so it will only get to just a cancer cell or a tumor cell to kill it, not a normal cell. So the technology that created the COVID vaccine has actually been around since 92. I read a really good book on it. And guess who invented it? It was a female, Jennifer Doudna. That's pretty amazing. Pretty cool. Sorry? Not the one they created. That came out of this other technology. So, we think about this then. The triglyceride synthesis or lipogenesis occurs when cellular ATP and glucose levels are high. So, excess ATP leads to accumulation of the intermediates of glucose metabolism, acetyl-CoA and glyceraldehyde, which, of course, then would feed back to the Krebs cycle. But if the Krebs cycle doesn't require them, then we end up in an excess of these two metabolites. So we have to do something with them. So because acetyl-CoA is the intermediate in glucose metabolism, it's also the starting point for the synthesis of fatty acids. So what happens is when we don't need glucose, guess what it becomes? Fat. Because we don't need it, right? So the body recognizes in terms of the ATP production, there's this buildup of all these compounds, and the body doesn't need them, but maybe needs them for a rainy day, so it flips them to fat so that it can be stored in adipose tissue. Understand, we're going to talk about adipose tissue probably next week. Adipose tissue is nothing more than a connective tissue that specializes in storing fat. Okay? You ever notice if you render down fat when you're cooking and the fat all disappears, you still have this white kind of chewy stuff. So that's the connective tissue. What you've done is you've broken out the cell membranes and the fat that was within that tissue has actually melted off and gone away. So you're left with the connective tissue that holds it.
So what is that versus glycogen?
Glycogen is it's a converted storing for acute needs when, but this is when you get beyond that. So you got your glycogen stores are up, you're not needing ATP anymore, and you got all this stuff, what am I going to do with it? Fat. Okay? So it doesn't matter with it. So, yeah. Yes, they're actually breaking down the connective tissue and ripping it out of your body.
So that the fat can't be stored there.
Right. But here's the thing, body's not stupid. If you continue in the same behaviors that gave you the fat in the first place, it just goes somewhere else to store rather than where they took it away. And you're genetically influenced as to where your fat stores are. And also gender influence. So females generally tend to store their adipose tissue in different places than men do. In fact, females tend to store their fat in much healthier areas than men do. Because this intra-abdominal fat is very dangerous. We now know with research, diabetes, heart disease. So if grandpa's got the watermelon, it's really not good. Because they think it, what it does is it doesn't get processed as well, so you end up getting more in the bloodstream, so you get streaky fat deposits in the coronary arteries, and because you just have so much kind of around it, and it's so clear to the liver that it just, shall we say, gums everything up. So therefore, glucose is easily converted to fat. Thus, if the diet is fat poor, excessive carbohydrate intake provides all the raw materials needed to form neutral fats. So that's the thing you have to remember. You know, vegans can get fat. Well, there's also a lot of calories. I mean, again, if you're sitting on your bum watching TV and not doing anything, and even though you're vegan, it may be somewhat healthier for many reasons, but you're still going to take excess calories and store them as fat. It doesn't make any difference. So it's all about the teeter-totter, right, as far as that goes. Lipolysis is the breakdown of stored fats into glycerol and fatty acids. When these products are created, they're then released in the blood, which allows fat fuels for aerobic respiration. The liver, cardiac muscle, and resting skeletal muscle do prefer fatty acids as a fuel source as compared to glucose, so they, because of the higher amount. So if, such as cardiac muscle, is aerobic only in terms of its metabolic requirements, it very much wants to use fatty acids. It'll give you those 129 ATPs rather than glucose that gives you the 36 because of the vast need of cardiac muscle just for its normal contractile requirements for its metabolic needs as a muscle tissue. Okay? Same as the brain. Your brain, I can't remember what it is. I read it some time ago. But the amount of calories your brain requires in any given day is vast. It's incredible. Your brain is just sucking up calories like crazy. You know, it requires it. Right. I can see that. I ask all you guys this. Who started really just kind of getting into vast amounts of potato chips and high-calorie foods yet? Yeah, okay. Anybody else? Like, you're studying and you're getting the craving for chips and cheesies? Come on. Why? Because you're using this every night, and guess what? You're craving calories. Because you're, like, remember I told you guys it's like a marathon? You guys know your brain's starting to get more in shape, right? If you're finding your studying is getting a bit easier, even though it's still challenging, you're hanging on to things a bit more because your brain's getting into shape now. It's getting used to reading that book every day and putting information in. But at the same time, because it uses calories, you may find that the potato chips are starting to taste pretty good because it does happen. Yes, well, sugar is not good. It has to be something that's a carbohydrate because you get the spike. But here's the thing. This is why it is so vitally important for children to have breakfast. They can't learn well if they're low in calories because the brain won't hang on to the information. And unfortunately, due to, I don't know, because parents are working, those sorts of things, my understanding is the number of, because I've got friends that are elementary school teachers, the number of children who come to school without breakfast is terrible. That's why they have breakfast programs. What's that? Yeah, they have to, because the research shows that eat for your brain to function properly. Also shows you that if you work out, you're better, but they got rid of gym class. Don't get me on that. Okay, proteins. So proteins have a limited lifespan and must be broken down into their amino acids and replaced before they begin to deteriorate. So if you want a prime example, take a hunk of celery, put it on the counter. Take a steak, put it on the counter, and leave it in your kitchen for about 5 days.
On the counter?
Yeah, just sitting there in the warmth. What's going to happen? Which smells worse? Yes, because proteins break down so much faster, right? So much faster. This is why when you have something dies, you know, in a very, very short period of time, they're breaking down. Like, it doesn't take much before What's that? Oh yeah, it's crazy. We had a dog die and on us, and he was a Sheltie, and I think he had a heart attack in the middle of the night, and I woke up, and poor guy was on the floor, he had his chin on his paws, and he wouldn't move, and he passed away sometime in the night. But when I picked him up, I could smell the rot already. It just, it's that quick. That's why when we process animals for food, we have to get the insides out as quickly as possible, because they're even faster than the muscle tissue. So proteins break down very, very quickly. So because of that, we need to deal with them very quickly in the body. So newly ingested amino acids transported in the blood are taken up by the cells by active transport and used to replace tissue proteins at a rate of 100 grams a day. There's your answer, 100 grams a day. Okay? So when we did protein synthesis, you may have asked yourself, well, where the heck do all those amino acids come from to create that messenger RNA and therefore then the polypeptide strand? It's because of us producing them and eating them. Again, you've got to replace them. You've got to eat them. They've got to, and they do go into all the cells in your body. So there always is or should be a full complement of all those amino acids in your cell at any given time so that your cell can make whatever protein is required at any given time. When more protein is ingested than is needed, amino acids are oxidized for energy or converted to fat. It's sad, isn't it? You got to work for 20 minutes or more just to start burning fat, but one McDonald's Big Mac and, right? It doesn't take much. It is the last thing that it'll use, but it'll use it if it has to. Oh, I think it was, I wouldn't know if it was toxic. I'm not sure. So when we think about what has to happen, I'll finish here. Maybe this will help. So before amino acids can be oxidized, they have to be deaminated. In other words, the amine group has to be removed. And you all know what that is. You've seen it all 100 times. You know what that is? When you deaminate a protein, you guys do it all the time. Or most of you probably do. Maybe on Sunday mornings or Saturday mornings? Something. So, what's an egg look like before you put it in the frying pan? So it's clear, right? It's clear. The albumin's clear. And what happens when you cook it? Yeah, you've deaminated it. You've broken down the amine groups. Okay? Yeah, you've changed it. Yeah. So it was clear when you took it out of the shell, and when you applied heat, you broke all those amino acids apart, and it changed to white.
Better to eat cooked eggs than raw.
Oh, yeah. Raw eggs are salmonella. But here's the cool thing. It's called entropy. Can you take that white egg and make it clear again? Nope. Right? So, anyway, so that's what you've done. So you're using heat to make chemical reactions to change the amino acids within the egg white. Egg white is albumin, and you carry albumin in your blood as well. It plays a number of roles. It's a type of protein or amino acids. So, yeah, you're deaminating when you do the white egg. Now, when you've removed the amine group, so the resulting molecule then is converted to pyruvic acid or one of the keto acid intermediates in the Krebs cycle. Okay? So keto diet is kind of working on your amine groups. But I've never heard it called toxic. I'd be curious. See if you can find it. I'd be curious. Because I do know that it's the last-ditch effort. The body will not turn to amino acids if it can help it, right, and, unless it absolutely has to. So this is why you see some of the results in third world nations where people are starving terribly and the child has the large belly and those sorts of things. Those are all the results of a body having to turn to eat itself because it's not getting nutrients anywhere else. They can't break it down because their whole system's not used to it. Now, I don't know what the mechanisms are. I do know that when, you know, in the Second World War, when they went into the concentration camps, they didn't know what was happening, and they did feed some of these individuals large amounts of money, and they died because of it. So there are mechanisms for sure that they, you know, they haven't eaten for, you know, who knows how many years, and their body's not just able to do with it, so they'd have to start with liquid food first and work accordingly. So.
It says here that excessive amounts may increase
Now that I would also say you would see those if other metabolic processes weren't functioning properly. So you had a disease like kidneys weren't working or something like that. You would kind of see that build up. Interesting. Okay. So guess what? We're done that stuff. Now, all we have left for cells is this. And we'll start that next week. So everybody remembers mitosis and meiosis.